It appears it's 9 o'clock, so welcome. So nice to have so many people here this morning, and we welcome back Hal Tosic, who is going to continue discussing the Gospel of Mary. I made the mistake of pulling out the Bible card this morning. I'm like, then I realized, we're not going to find it in there, are we? So I pushed it back. So welcome, Hal. We so look forward to today.
Thanks so much, Sharon. Well, yes, so we are in the middle of 2 days of studying the Gospel of Mary. I know some of you came in yesterday, and some weren't able to come. So I'm going to take the first few minutes to summarize the Gospel of Mary itself, and then we'll go on to a specific text within the Gospel of Mary that we will study a bit today, but frankly, what I've prepared mostly is a spiritual exercise. So we'll be doing a spiritual exercise on a text from the Gospel of Mary, and then we'll have some time to talk about it as well. And as I said to some of you, when one starts studying these texts that were eventually outside the Christian canon, there's so much to catch up with. So if you have some extra questions or thoughts, please feel free to grab me outside of the time, and we can sit down and talk about that. We don't have any sessions on this this year, because the last 2 years I've been giving some more basic material. But the basic thing that has happened in the last 150 years, I claim, is probably the most important thing that happened to the Bible in the last 1500. And that is that people found almost 125, around 125, new documents from the earliest 2 centuries of the beginning of the Christ and Jesus movements. 125 new texts. Just let that sink in. The reason that it happened is kind of curious. I don't think it was ordained by anybody. But it turned out that in the 19th century, the Europeans started going on vacation to the southern Mediterranean, because especially the rich Mediterraneans had money to go on extended vacations to North Africa and the eastern end of the Mediterranean. And along with those relatively wealthy people that did that, a lot were some biblical scholars. And what they bumped into without any intention were documents that they'd never seen or heard of before, that especially North Africans had found. And so basically then, archaeological expeditions and more scholars at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century started going to spend years in North Africa and the eastern end of the Mediterranean to look for new documents. Why did they find them? It's mainly because it was dry in North Africa. So in other words, if the Gospel of Mary, which was found in Egypt, if it had been found in Syria, it would have been too wet and it would have disintegrated. So we found almost all of these new 125 documents in North Africa. There are a couple of other, one of my favorite texts we're going to study on Thursday and Friday, and that has another really funny and goofy story. And Joan is holding in her hands, if anyone wasn't here and wants a copy of the Gospel of Mary, this, we handed that out yesterday. A bunch of you have it, I know. I got some of those. So anyway, that's what's happened. And if you need a catch-up conversation about all of this new thing, that's fine. By and large, of these 125 documents that were found, many of them are mentioned but were never known. In other words, some people in the early part of the Christian history knew them and had them, and they were lost for some reason. And by and large, no documents of the first five centuries say about these documents that we've now found, don't read them. Or don't put them in your New Testament. I have a lecture that I probably won't give this year, but we can have conversation about it, and that is, how did the New Testament itself come into being? It turned out that, unlike I thought for so many years, it didn't fall whole cloth from heaven and hit us on the head.
What?
But, you know, that's our assumption, is that it is actually made by God, thrown down from heaven. So anyway, just that's what we're not talking about today, but grab me and talk to me about it. I love to do that. Let's just summarize a little bit of the Gospel of Mary, and our real handouts for today are two-sided. On the first side, what I would call the first side that's not labeled, says Gospel of Mary, Magdalene in parentheses. Some of you from yesterday know that we don't know whether it's Mary Magdalene or not, because it's just Mary, and 25% of all women in Galilee in the first century were named Mary. So we think of Mary Magdalene, we're not sure. So let me just briefly, on page one, before we go into our spiritual exercise, on this one text, I want to go over it. So, range of possible composition. We think that the Gospel of Mary was written somewhere between 90 and 175. That's a big stretch. And frankly, we'll know more probably in 50 years. I have a bunch of PhD students who've gone through me, and they'll be working in 50 years. I won't. And so they will have found out more. I frankly, along with Karen King, my good colleague from Harvard, and we've worked together a lot on the Gospel of Mary, and disagree about a lot in the Gospel of Mary, we think it's about 125, which would put it right at about the same time as most scholars are now putting the Gospel of Luke. There's lots to say about that, of why. And again, as I said yesterday, please understand when I make these grand pronouncements, think, Hal is probably lying. Because it's 2,000 years ago, it's across many cultures, and we really only know about 10% of what we need to know. So that's kind of when the Gospel of Mary might have been written. The authorship is unknown. It's called the Gospel of Mary not because that is somehow supposed to be who wrote it. It's the main character. So the main character in this story is Mary. The only gospel that we know of whose main character is a woman. Two manuscripts exist. Both of them are partial. So in other words, we don't have the whole manuscript at all. But we have enough to make actually a really good story. Both of the manuscripts we have been damaged substantially. That, by the way, is true of all biblical manuscripts. So in other words, if I show you the first 10 copies we have of the Gospel of Mark, they're from the 3rd century, and they're all damaged. So we don't have any original anythings. Just to say, I think what was felt yesterday is, so it is an amazing loss, I want to say, to have lost the Gospel of Mary for so long. It deserves to guide people in their lives today. It clearly did guide people. The two manuscripts we have are in two different languages, so we know it was distributed widely. It was clearly a very important guide for many people in the ancient world too. So I don't mean to say, that's just what I feel after my several decades working on this material. Other people feel differently.
What were the languages?
Coptic and Greek.
What's Coptic again?
Coptic is an alphabetized Egyptian. It's the Egyptian of Egypt, the Egyptian language of that time. But when the Greeks and the Romans took over Egypt for a long period during this time, they said, you're not fashionable because you're still reading in hieroglyphics. We want you to have an alphabetized language. So Coptic is the alphabetized language that was hieroglyphic. So, and the people that, you remember hieroglyphics, it's a pictorial language like Chinese is. But the rulers, the Roman and Greek rulers said, oh, you're not up to date, so you should have an alphabetized
language. Is it phonetic?
It's phonetic, huh? Yeah. Okay, so just now here so you can pick up the whole Gospel of Mary, which is only six or seven columns and fits on 1.5 pages. But I've given you here on page one a summary of the content. So the first three chapters, as far as we can tell, of the Gospel of Mary are missing. So we begin in chapter 4, and there the Savior, meaning Jesus, is in the process of leaving. That's not like leaving on vacation or to go buy something. It's leaving. It's his farewell. So that's in chapter 4. And there, in that case, and you'll see there what Jesus basically does as he leaves is he summarizes his ministry. You'll see there, when the Blessed One had said these things, he greeted them all, and this is only partial part of it. You can see the whole thing in the other copy. Peace be with you, the child of humanity is within you, follow it. Those who seek it will find it. Go then and proclaim the good news of the realm. When he had said this, he departed really. In the next part, when Jesus leaves, the disciples start crying. And they say, if they killed him, what'll they do to us? And Mary steps forward and says, don't cry. I gotcha. I'm going to remind you of what he said to you. Peter says, well, yeah, we know that Jesus loved you better than us. And he probably talked to you more than us. So could you tell us what he said to you? And she said, yeah, okay. And then, by the way, that's the part that we're going to study today, is what Jesus told Mary, and then Mary told the other disciples. In other words, Mary is pictured as the lead disciple in this gospel. Then she tells what, and we'll study this in some depth, especially in a spiritual exercise, what Jesus said. Then, at the end, Peter and Andrew get up and say, we don't believe it. Mainly because it just doesn't sound like him. And why would he have told a woman? So, get this, gender contestation in an ancient gospel with a woman being the major character. Now that is a find. And then Mary starts crying because they don't believe her. Then Levi stands up and says, Peter, you've always been a hothead. Remember, he loved her better than us. And then in one version, they all go out and announce this good news. In another version, only Levi goes out. So that's my quick and dirty description of what we did yesterday. And we talked mostly about some of the things that where Mary had crises in this story. Let me stop here. As those of you who've been with me for the last two times know, I like to be interrupted. I like questions, protests, and the like. Let me stop here before we go into the text for today and see if any folks have something to say.
Is there any evidence that they were hidden purposely because Mary was a woman?
No, no.
They were just
at least
lost.
That is a possibility. Mm-hmm. For instance, the Da Vinci Code says that. Mm-hmm. And the Da Vinci Code has a lot to it and a lot wrong with it. Yeah. It seems possible. Certainly it does happen to some documents. But we have no document at all that says, no, don't read the Gospel of Mary.
Is there an indication that Mary is supposed to be one of those who goes forth and
yeah,
says the good news?
Yeah, the implication is in the one version, it's lovely, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there are different versions of the Gospel of Mary. And so they disagree with each other in their manuscript. So I frankly love that one of them ends on a pretty tension-filled and in which only Levi goes out, and the other in a kind of triumphant.
The one where only Levi goes out is the director's cut. You have to watch the other part of the DVD.
Yeah, maybe. Yes.
Is it possible it's written by Mary's followers or even women years after Mary?
One of its main points is that women and men are contesting one another for leadership, and that the story itself is written from the point of view of women's leadership, I think means that, there's a possibility of authorship.
Are they educated enough to be able to write?
Well, I'm trying to discipline myself here to not say too much. You know that problem. In terms of literacy, we think 90% of all people in the Mediterranean and North Africa are illiterate. So 10% know how to read. So reading is a public gesture. When you learn to read, you always read out loud because it's not no one reads privately. Even so, if you see somebody practicing their reading in a room, they'll be saying it in a loud voice. And of the literate, we do know that some women read. Again, I would say probably 10% of the 10% read. So that means less likely, but not impossible. All right, so we're going to turn the page. And what I'd like us to do is basically be in not so much study, but mainly meditative mode for much of the rest of the hour. We'll come back together and I'll give you some directions. This is the part of the Gospel of Mary where Mary tells the disciples what Jesus told her in a separate conversation. You may feel like Andrew and Peter by the end of this text, meaning this doesn't sound like him. This is a voice that's quite different. Something's happening up there. So let me read. I've just summarized. You have the whole version when you in the Gospel of Mary. I'm going to just summarize the story. This is what Mary said, Jesus said. It's called the ascent of the soul. The soul was ascending to God. As it traveled toward God, it came to the second power, which is called desire. Desire challenged the soul as to where the soul was going. The soul said it was going to God, but desire interrogated the soul as to its worthiness. The soul responded to desire about the soul's capacity to go to God and explained that desire had misunderstood the soul in all its complexities. And the soul proceeded toward God in joy. As the soul went toward God, it met ignorance. Ignorance examined the soul, asking where it was going and warning against the possibility that the soul was under the power of something wicked. Here, too, the soul responded, agreeing that it had been ruled by an alien force, but knowing that all things are being released. And then the soul ascended further. Then the soul saw another power, full of all kinds of danger, but characterized best as anger. Anger also asked the soul whence it came and where it was going. The soul reassured that it was no longer under the control of forces beyond itself. The soul rested in silence, content that its desire was fulfilled, its ignorance was behind it, and its process complete. So that's the story. We're going to meditate on that, but I want to give you some directions. Oh. Yes?
I got to say, hearing this and reading it, it kind of reminds me of apocalyptic writing. It's sort of like a puzzle being worked out.
Yeah, except it's not interested in the end times.
Well, not all apocalyptic.
Yeah, right.
Is.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's a nice analogy. Here's what I'd like you to do. I've got pieces of paper here and pencils that you may want to use, you may not. You may want to just do this in your head. So first I'm going to ask, when I stop talking, that you review the story. Secondly, in this exercise, if you would, so these are things kind of, try not to think this at least during your meditation. Lay at least temporarily aside the conventional notion that desire, ignorance, and anger are completely negative forces. I would want to say that what we just read does not portray them that way. It portrays them as challenging forces. But much conventional religion says that ignorance, desire, and anger are wrong. If you could just hold that a little bit to the side, as you meditate. Similarly, place at least temporarily in abeyance the idea that the process of the soul going to God is an event of an afterlife. Now here I want to say just a little bit of scholar talk. So it turns out the ancient world is full of stories about the soul going to God. The interesting thing for us in our day is that many of those stories aren't about the soul going to God after death. Rather, they're about the soul going to God within one's life. I want to say it's almost sure that this is the case of the gospel narrative. But, for instance, in the canon, in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says, hey, I went to the third heaven and came back. So in other words, Paul himself tells a story about him ascending to God and coming back. And that's not when he's dead. He said that's, you know, that happened, he said, about 7 years ago. Okay, and notice in this story that the soul is in process more than it is a complete, stable entity. Okay, then what I would like you to do, and you hold this in your hand, and if you can't remember it, put yourself in the role of the soul. So for your meditation, think that you are on this journey to God. Picture it. And walk in or with the soul through the story in the following manner. As you, or the soul, encounter desire, ignorance, and anger, in each case, Have a conversation with these respective powers. Have a conversation with anger. Have a conversation with desire and ignorance. Note in your mind or heart or on paper where each power has given you gifts, where anger, ignorance, and desire has given you gifts, sustenance, expressiveness, and or spirit. Similarly, note where each power has damaged, deformed, caricatured you, or made you addicted. So in other words, ask that about anger in your life, about desire in your life, and ignorance in your life. At the end, after you've done that, and you can write that down if you want to, it might be valuable, it might not. Feel gratitude, feel regret, and ambivalence of your life in relationship to desire, ignorance, and anger. So frankly, what I'm up to as imposing this meditation on you is, what I'm up to is for us to get a chance through the story, not our story quite, but the story of the soul that we find in this text, to feel gratitude, regret, and ambivalence about your life. If you want during that time, pray silently about it. Give God gratitude, regret, and ambivalence. Take some moments at the end then, with or as the soul, as it rests in peace and silence. That's what happens at the end in the story. Questions? Anyone want to leave now? I mean, some of you, because I'm known to bring on heady topics, you may not have known that you walked into a prayer meeting this morning or something like that. Okay, I think you have your directions. I will give you a notice of when we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. And that'll be before, that we'll have some time to talk. Any questions? The pencils are right here, and so are the, and the blue are the pieces of paper. Right. I'm assuming many of you know how you do your own meditation and prayer, so but those are the kind of the overarching possibilities that I've given you.
What was the timing, Cal?
I'm giving you 18 and a half minutes.
You got a stopwatch?
No, I'm just joking. Around 15 to 20 minutes, so you have some time. I'll ask you now, you put your papers down if you are occupied with them. And let's just finish this off with that part of the story that has the soul resting in silence. So you've engaged these powers, and let's take a moment to rest and come back together. So one of the things that's wrong with this exercise that I've given you is that it doesn't have enough time. It stirs us up. And I felt halfway okay about it in that I didn't know that for most of us, not all of us in the room, but for most of us, we'll have some more time to continue this exercise. And I would especially encourage you to continue it if you're bothered by it or if you're engaged by it. If it's boring, then just forget it. But if it bothers us, it seems to me like it actually is asking for more time. And if it is, and if it's engaging, that's clear. So in the, and I'm going to just be here afterwards. If people want to stay after the 10 o'clock hour. But I'm going to divide this time into two kinds of processing. One is simply, how was this for you? I would encourage you not to tell us if it's too important for you. But if there's something that seems that you can say negatively or positively about it or confusedly about it, that's fine. And then we'll save 5 minutes actually to go back to the Gospel of Mary and this interpretational lens of the Gospel of Mary. So first then, anybody want to say anything about their being a soul traveling to God?
I never thought of it that way before. But I ended up with ambivalence mainly. At age 84, I want to do things. I desire to do things, but my body won't let me. But my brain keeps working, and this is really great.
Thank you.
I like the idea of the soul on a journey, not static. The dynamic idea of meeting and interacting and moving through. It made me release some ideas about being static and unchangeable.
In that vein, it caused me to realize that I can't control everything. I have to just, you know, as much as we want to control what happens, sometimes it's just not, you know, you can't do that.
I liked that the soul is on a journey of like, acquiring knowledge and gaining experience, and that it's not all good or all bad. The complexities mean that there's subtleties and gray area and on a journey.
I liked your description of this not happening after we die, but before we die, because I kind of call it, you know, I refer to it differently. I describe us as being on a faith journey together. We're on a road, and we're just moving along together, dealing with the, you know, challenges and the accomplishments and the fears and the anxieties and the love and the help along the way. So it does make a lot of sense to me that you would call it a soul journeying to God.
Yeah.
There is a destination, isn't there?
And again, as far as I'm concerned, thinking about afterlife is deep and rich for many of us. But here, anger, ignorance, and desire are so primary in our lives now. Mm-hmm. So that be a part of a journey to God now really coheres as a scripture.
I wonder, so I had a question. I wonder if many of us don't realize we're on the journey.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's so much tendency to either feel totally lost or totally there.
Or the desire to skip ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I want that encounter with the divine, but I don't want to have to talk to myself about my desire and my ignorance and my own anger, right? Like, I don't want, I just want, I want to be filled, right?
Or conversely, to believe that the journey starts after we've dealt with desire and ignorance and anger.
Right.
I can't, you know, leave the station until I've done that.
Good luck, huh?
I guess it'd be kind of like in the labyrinth, when you walk labyrinth, you release all your ignorance and fear, and then in the center, you center yourself and then go out and continue your journey.
Yeah, let's go with you, Janine, first, and then.
I was thinking as I looked at the text again, as it started with the second power, I was thinking about Augustine of Hippo, which was third in the 300s. So wondered if he had read the text as his quote is, you know, the. The hole in the soul is only God can fill that hole in the soul, and wondered if that, you know, affected him, if he saw this text, and just made me wonder.
Beautiful. Hey?
Well, I was just recognizing these as constant traveling companions of mine. I don't think when I was younger that I realized that I was going to be traveling with them all of my journey.
Yeah.
And how we cycle through them and around them in all of the traveling that we do. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to recognize them. Yeah.
I think we all think of life as a journey where we're going to solve all of these things. And like, when I get there, I'll know it, and I'll be great, and life will be fine. But Peg, you're absolutely right. It's with us continually. And I think if we realize that it's just part of our journey, and these are the things we're going to encounter on our way, it's maybe a little easier to deal with it.
Into my mind comes a text, as Handel said it to music, "O rest in the Lord, wait patiently for him, and he will give thee thy heart's desire. Commit thy ways unto him, and rest in him, and fret not thyself because of evildoers. O rest in the Lord."
That has a lot of that text in it. One text cozying up to another.
I was thinking about when Jesus says, "Be perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect," and in the Methodist tradition, they talk about Jesus as the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, and that idea of journeying toward—if you think about perfect as oneness with the divine—that the steps along the way are necessary to that journey toward perfection, which, in the Methodist understanding, is achievable on earth. Well, and if everything belongs, the traveling companions are part of it. So.
Yeah, it's part of being human, I think. And it's, for me, it's, you know, this is, I can be pretty spiritually lazy sometimes, so this was good to put forth some effort and, you know, concentrate a little bit and this journey, and then recognize those three things that are with us, and deal with them, because we have to keep doing that.
I was surprised at the gifts that some of these elements have given me. I had not thought of it that way before, but I've learned things about others and about myself and gained things from them, and you generally think of all of these as negatives and put them aside.
Yeah, and I think actually Christian tradition is responsible for clamping down on the, I think Scripture is much more at ease with ignorance, anger, and desire than later Christian tradition is. So one of the offensivenesses about me leading you in this is that I'm going to stop this part of the conversation and apologize, but also invite further conversation. But let's think, I'm just a Bible nerd or scripture nerd in one way or another. I want to actually, because this is a new text and because I think we need to have scripture as meditative companions at least as much as thoughtful companions. And so just want to say a little bit and hear from you a little bit about going back to the Gospel of Mary. So one thing I would want to caution you about in terms of Mary's relationship to what we've done is that there, so for instance, one of my dearest friends, Karen King, who's a sister scholar of this text, written the best book on the Gospel of Mary, thinks that all three of those powers are negative. And so we have great arguments about that. But just to say that, and her basis within that is from the Stoicism of that day. So Stoicism sees these three things in the ancient world as negative. I think that the early Christ movements don't think of anger and especially anger and desire as negative necessarily, but rather empowering. So just to tell you that you're being not completely supported by all of scholarship if you go, if you take another walk with this, with text in this way today. Similarly, just to say that this question about anger, ignorance, and desire in the ancient world is very alive. So just like Karen and I are arguing about it, actually in the ancient world, there's a lot of energy around, well, what is anger doing for us or to us? Or what is desire doing for us or to us? In other words, if you can return to all kinds of scriptures and just continue the conversation or the spiritual dialogue, I think there's some merit. Any questions you have or thoughts about the text itself? Yes.
Okay, I know it's missing, but any thoughts about what the spark is for this soul to start it?
Yeah, I mean, I frankly trust the story a lot. In other words, what has just happened before in the story is the disciples are all crying because Jesus left them and they're afraid they're going to get killed. And Mary steps into that breach and says, listen, Jesus is still going to be with you in another way. And remember that as it says throughout the text, it says, he's made you to be humans. I mean, that's a good thing. So I think that is very full of tension and raises, and so in other words, the disciples are asking the question, what next? And she then tells a story that she has gotten from Jesus about a journey. So I think it actually, so the context is the danger and fraughtness of the story itself. Oh, I'm over. I'm sorry. See you tomorrow. And I'll just hang here for a while if you want.